Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Hi, welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Maria DeMars.
And joining us here today, our lovely guest,
Kiana Patterson.
So, Kiana, welcome to the podcast, where we rant about whatever we feel like today, and where we give tips on being more than ordinary. So we'd like to start out with just a little background on you. Maria said, you must have this woman, Kiana, and I will tell you a story that you don't know. So I went to the incubator school, and I was on this panel, and I came back. And I said to Maria, yeah, there's this really interesting woman in there. We should connect with her because she seems to know a lot about education. And I just like her style and attitude. I think, yeah, we should get to know her. And Maria said, what's her name? And I said, Kiana. And she's like, no.
I think I said, oh, well, I'm having coffee with her tomorrow. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You have kind of a untraditional career path, people might say.
Very, very, very. So, when I was in my senior year of undergrad, I was thinking, I'll just apply to grad school. And I had a professor who said, no, join the Peace Corps, do something, get real world experience. So I actually decided to teach. That was my version of the Peace Corps, minus all of the shots that you would have to take to travel to another country, because I was deathly afraid of shots. So I moved to Los Angeles from Seattle, and I became a sixth grade teacher and discovered within a year and a half that I loved it. And I was actually in the classroom for 5 years, went back to school, got my teaching credential, spent 2 years out of the classroom as the dean of discipline and helping sort of revitalize the culture of the school. And after 7 years, I said, I love teaching, but I don't know if I'm better at something else. And at that point, I decided to walk away from my tenure and my seniority and say, I said to myself, can I be better at something else? If I fail, then I can always go back to teaching. It's not like there's not plenty of positions for teachers. And I walked out and I said, what am I going to do? I hadn't thought that far in advance. And I wound up at a small tech company here in Los Angeles, a content management system provider for schools. And I started out as their trainer and I worked my way up. So for the last almost 12 years, I've been in the ed tech space. So it's a crossroads of technology and education.
So what is that like? Because since this is a podcast and people can't see you, I'm guessing that as an African-American woman, when you walk into a company or you walk into a tech meetup, you may maybe have these same experiences that Maria and I have, that people don't say, oh, I'll bet she's the CEO, or I'll bet she's one of the software developers. They think you're lost, or the wait staff, or the marketing.
Or a salesperson, or someone who doesn't know anything. So that's been a really interesting experience going into conferences, especially like education ed tech conferences, and people assuming that I was a teacher. So if I'm walking the halls or, you know, in and out of sessions, they think, well, I'm either working at the conference center or I am a teacher. And so it's been really shocking for some people to find out that, you know, I'm a COO of an ed tech company that's in the multi-million. So that's, it's been a really interesting ride. It's fascinating that it's okay for me to be conference staff or a teacher, but if for whatever reason in people's minds and heads, I can't be an executive in a tech company.
You know, and that probably goes into why you are a real advocate for diversity in tech and ed tech. And just what spurred that? How did that come about to be kind of a real passion for yours?
Being the only one. You know, at some point you get tired of being the only one. And that means that I don't think that I always have the right answer. I don't think that my experience is the only one that's out there. And I think that oftentimes we say, when you get to the top, bring others with you. I don't believe that I should wait until the top to bring others along with me. I think that as I'm moving up or, you know, advancing, however you look at it, I should be bringing others with me. And those others should be people like me. Others should be those who are traditionally left out.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I had a doctoral student at Pepperdine. Shout out to Dr. Shanetta Robinson. And her doctoral dissertation was on African-American women in the C-suite. And she had interviewed these women who were CEOs of very large organizations. And one of the comments I remember she cited in her dissertation from an interview was a woman who said, if you make it to the top and you don't reach down to the person behind you, she said, shame on you, leave the ladder down. That was her term. And I just thought that was very impressive because unfortunately I have run into people in my career that were the opposite of that, that it's sort of, I got mine and screw all the rest of you people. And I do think that leave the ladder down is a really good way to live your life.
Yeah. And I think that for some of us who advance and move forward, it's scary to use your power and influence to bring in others like you because you're afraid that they may make a mistake, that they may mess up, and that will be a poor reflection on you. But the inverse is the opposite of that for others who are, it's when it's a male-dominated suite, when it's traditionally all Caucasian males, they're not worried about whether or not they bring in their nephew or their friend's son and that person royally screws up during their internship, that somehow poorly reflects on them and that everyone's going to question their judgment from that point on. But we, because we have so few opportunities to be there, we're afraid. And I know that I've experienced that earlier on. But at some point, I just said, screw it. I'm not going to worry about that. And I'm not just going to bring people in and let them fend for themselves. I'm going to bring people in and I'm going to mentor and I'm going to coach and I'm going to help them be successful there. So when we leave the ladder down, we're all constantly helping people up. We just can't like leave it there and go, well, the ladder's there. Find your way up. It's leaving the ladder there, standing there, watching people attempt to come up and pulling them up with you.
Well, and I think for a lot of women and minorities, there's this concern when they get into organizations like that where you are the only minority, you are the only woman, and therefore you, not by choice, are deemed almost reflective of everyone else. So you mess up. It's not just, oops, it's they say, well, we tried that once, but.
Right.
Well, I remember when I was teaching in North Dakota, and there's a young man, in fact, I know what he's doing now. He's quite successful. He just sent me an email like 20 years later and said, how are you doing? Trinell Weaver. So shout out to Trinell too. And he was African-American with the very, very, very few in Jamestown, North Dakota. So every time we were talking about things like bias in mental testing or something like that, and I would notice when certain things would come up, like there was a lot of stuff written when I was in graduate school about how African-Americans are genetically less intelligent. There were all these horrible eugenic studies. So whenever anything would come up like that, like everybody in the class would turn and look at Trinell. And so, I'm lecturing, I'm writing the board. So one day I said to him, hey, what's the deal here? Are you like making faces behind my back or something? And he goes, no, it happens in all my classes because I'm like the one black guy here. He says, whenever anything comes up that has to do with race, everybody turns and looks at me and literally turned and looked at him. And I just thought, well, that's got to be annoying.
Right, right. And I know that there's a certain level of anxiety that, you know, forms in us because that everyone's sort of going to be looking at us as a model citizen. And for an example, I'm assuming that the president has experienced that a lot. We've seen that probably tenfold. We probably couldn't imagine. Funny, someone I saw on Twitter the other day that someone sort of said, hey, it would be really cool if the president decided to move into the VC world after he leaves the White House. And then someone commented like, oh my gosh, he would instantly make partner in any VC firm. And I chimed in and I said, that's funny because that just goes to show you what a black man's resume and experience must be in order to be partner at a VC firm. Like that's what that shows.
Well, and it's the same thing with women. I remember something on Twitter where people talked about, oh, we don't get enough women to speak at conferences. And I did a blog post. I'm supposed to not swear more than twice per episode, so I might save it till I need it later. But I did a blog post on that and said, you know, these guys who say, well, we tried to get a woman, but Sheryl Sandberg wasn't available. Well, did they get Mark Zuckerberg or they didn't have any men? No. So exactly what you said, the criteria we expect for a woman, a minority, is often very different.
Mm-hmm. It's completely different. And I wish that it wasn't like that. And but unfortunately, it is. And we just need to keep pressing forward, as painful and as sometimes difficult it is, and egregious sometimes the experiences that we have to face. I know that I've faced tons of things, and I've told my male counterparts some of the stories, and they're like, I can't even imagine as a man experiencing that.
It's time I plan my trip around the world for my next adventure! Geek Nation Tours? Who are they?
Geek Nation Tours is the premier company for finding the perfect geek vacation.
Ah! Who are you?
I'm the guy who's here to tell you that Geek Nation Tours is a company whose tours are filled by people who love the same things you love and will get all of your obscure references.
Sounds great! How do I find out more?
You can look them up at www.geeknationtours.com and sign up for the tour that's right for you. And remember that Geek Nation Tours is all about love.
Yay!
Hi guys, this is Charity Wood from Bye Bye Robot. You can find out more about us at byebyerobot.com, and that's byebyerobot.com. And you're listening to More Than Ordinary.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm still Dr. Anne Maria DeMars.
And still with us is wonderful Kiana Patterson.
Hi.
So we wanted to talk a bit about really cool things that are going on in education, educational technology in particular. So what do you think the coolest things going on right now are?
Right off the bat, games, and more importantly, what VR will mean in education and games for students across the country, in the world, actually.
We're super excited about that. We just got a new grant funded. So next year, we're going to start adding VR, virtual reality, to our games. And even with the current games, I agree with you, obviously, since we run a gaming company. But I think so much of games that I've seen in my life are what I call the shooting and, you know, shooting and spelling, shooting and multiplication. So it's like, shoot at all the cars that have a word that has a double letter, or shoot the answer to the problem, and then you'll have 3 times 5, and they're supposed to shoot the 15. And all of it is memorization and speed. And as someone who spent my entire career using math as an engineer, as a software developer, as a statistician, there aren't a lot of times in my life when I'm called on to solve a bunch of multiplication and addition questions as rapidly as possible. There's never a day when I sit at my desk and I just have to answer, what's 8 times 7? What's 4 times 6? What's 4 plus 4? What's 8 plus 11? And yet that's how we teach math.
As mortally afraid of math student as I will say that I'm so glad that my life and my career and day-to-day, even now, doesn't require me to randomly shoot off multiplication tables. But what I am thankful for is experiential learning and immersive learning that allows me to use my creativity and obviously math and science. But, you know, I think those are the things and the skills that we need to be giving students today, as opposed to just learning a multiplication table.
Well, and when you talk about immersive experiences, I think one of the things that really makes, no matter whether it's math or science or even literature, click with students is this idea of in context, how it actually applies to my life. You know, like you're saying, I don't need to know 5 times 5 because somebody just is going to run into my office and shout it to me. But, you know, if me and 5 friends are going out to lunch and it's $5 each, then how much should we expect the bill to be? That kind of real practical applications.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, those practical applications have global implications, like where do we want our students to go and be able to do? And if we don't give them the type of experiences and like you said, the type of scenarios that they will actually encounter in their lives, then we're setting them up for failure. So we talk a lot about things like students need to be bilingual, which I'm completely supportive of. What if we said also, if I get plopped and I'm going to Greece this summer, I land in Greece, I don't know Greek. What am I going to do? How am I going to communicate with people while I'm in Greece who may not speak English, right, at some points? And so what is it in my background, my experience, my learning that's going to help me communicate, whether it's, you know, hand gestures or whatever? Like, how am I going to creatively solve communicating with people who speak an entirely different language?
Maria and I have had that experience in Greece.
How fun is it going to be?
We were in a taxi and we were going to meet someone, and they were behind a kind of a security point, right? So we pull up, the taxi has to stop. The man says something to the taxi driver, the guard with the large weapon, and then the taxi driver says something back in Greek, and then the taxi driver rolls down the back window, and the man with the large weapon says something to us in Greek, and we look at each other, not understanding Greek, and so he speaks it louder.
As if that meant you wouldn't understand?
Exactly. And at that point, I turned to her and I said, well, I got nothing. But I think we looked harmless enough and clueless enough that clearly we weren't there to pull out some elaborate security breach kind of scenario.
Thank goodness.
It was because Rhonda was in the Athens Olympics, just to clarify, that while we were there with security and a guy with a large weapon, it wasn't like we were trying to execute a prison break in Greece.
Got it. Well, I think that I will be using my my phone to help me translate certain things, right, when I get real stuck.
Yes, this was before the smartphone penetration where there were apps for everything.
Right,
so,
right.
Especially Greek's one of those where you can't even, like, if you look in one of those dictionaries, you can't really read how it. You pronounce it.
Correct, yeah. Correct.
So getting onto the idea of things in context, I don't think it even has to be the real life context. So, for example, it could be a storyline. Mm-hmm. And I think about the stories in these games, you know, there's certain experiences you have that stand out in your mind. And one of them was when I was at Tadetoba Elementary School, Four Winds, on the Spirit Lake Dakota Nation. And my friend and I were walking through the school, and he happened to be both, at the time, the president of the school board and a grandfather. And one of his grandchildren comes up to him and was probably trying to get out of something, because the little boy was maybe 9 or 10, and says, I don't need to learn math because I'm an Indian and that's not part of our culture. And my friend is very big into his culture, right? So his grandsons figure I'm getting out of it this way. And Eric looks down at him and he says, we were a nomadic people, because he's Dakota. And he says, we traveled thousands of miles around the plains. Do you think that we just by accident happened to end up in the same spot at the same time for trading or for powwows? He says, no. You know, our ancestors used math too. They understood estimation. They understood computation. How long is it going to take me to get from this spot to another? Do you think they just never ran out of food from luck? No, they could kind of calculate how much they would need to get through the winter. So those ideas went into the games that we made, so that you're saving your tribe. You're out trying to kill enough deer that you have enough food for the winter, you have enough hides for clothes. And we have people who are upset about that too, speaking of culture. They say, why are they killing the deer, the buffalo? Can't they make friends with them? We're not sure those people quite have the idea of history, that they have not quite grasped that.
Right. I think that part is super important, because we want students to sort of think abstractly, outside of the, you know, like, I use math to pay for my bill, right? But thinking about, if I didn't have a calculator or whatever, how would I calculate the days? Like, what would I use in my day-to-day that tells me a day has gone by or whatever? And I think in historical times, that is exactly what people did. And that's how they, various nomadic tribes, figured out how to do that. And our students need to know those type of things, because they're going to be put in situations where they should know how to calculate certain things like that and collaborate and figure out, like, what can I do in this situation?
The day where the iPhone battery died.
There you go. I've had it. We have all had it. And imagine your phone dying. I was in Rome 2 summers ago. My phone died. I had walked probably 7 miles that day. I don't speak Italian. I sort of remember the name of my hotel, and I had to get back to my hotel. And it was night was coming, right? The sun was setting. And so I had to, in that experience, I had to figure it out. I literally had to figure out. And so I started looking at locations and buildings that I recognized to lead me to my hotel. It was really dark by the time I got there, but I did make it back safe.
And the reality is you probably had a little bit of a sense of accomplishment that you may not have had your iPhone just steered you right back.
Honey, I felt really happy. I was alive and I was happy.
And I think what that shows, too, some is once we have technology, we sometimes quit paying attention to the other things. Like, I have the world record of most times lost in America.
Oh, no.
But I thought the GPS was the greatest invention ever. But I go hiking in the mountains sometimes, and I never get lost. Lots of times if I'm doing a conference, if I'm speaking on statistics or on educational gaming somewhere, like in Oregon or in North Dakota in the summer, not the winter, Wyoming, I'll try and schedule in some extra time and go hiking, and I never get lost.
Does this mean that you could teach me how to use a Thomas guide?
Well, I actually could, but the reason I don't get lost hiking, I'll notice where those rocks are. I'll notice where that tree is because I know there's no GPS that I can put in. Where's my car? And it will say, go to the third tree, take a left. And when you get to those rocks at the top of the hill, go to right. So
that means you're being present, right? You're present in that very moment, in that very day, which I think in our tech filled, iPhone, whatever, craze-filled life, we fail to be present in the here and now. And I like to say that we can't control the future and we can't certainly control the past. The only thing that we control at this very moment is the present moment we're living in right this second.
I want to pull a completely different topic. Well, somewhat related topic. Anyway, we were talking earlier about the opportunities that kids have to see things online or virtually that they don't in real life. And I think that's one of the great benefits of technology that the people sometimes overlook. For example, you said, kids don't always get a chance to go to the Natural History Museum, but you can go online and see some amazing pictures and videos that maybe it's not the same as being there, but if you can't be there, you can basically travel all over the world. And when I was a kid, I was a big fan of the library, still am. I couldn't believe you could go there and they would give you books for free. Mm-hmm. And all you had to do is bring back, they would give you new ones. It's amazing. And there used to be a saying that, you could travel the world through a book, but now it's quadruply true with technology. So I think that's another way we've opened things for kids.
I'm super excited about enabling students to be able to explore not only their city or their state, but the world that they live in, right? Things that they're interested in, like what does it look like in a day in Japan? What does it look like in the Amazon rainforest? And I think that those are the types of experiences that will essentially open up kids' ability to imagine what they can do and be. We just can't shift students only to programming or only like, so coding is big and we're telling everyone they should learn CS and they should learn to code, which I believe is a great thing. But there's going to be so many other things that we still need. We still need marine biologists. We still need just anthropologists. We still need so many other people. And this is a way that students can open up their world essentially with just one click of the button. And I'm excited about virtual reality, making it more, I don't know how they call it, but more of a reality. They feel like they're immersed in that experience, in that place, in that time, as opposed to just reading information and seeing pictures flat.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I went to GDC a couple months ago, and you just look at, obviously the virtual reality headsets is big, but there are some of these things where it's, seeing it from the perspective of a bird, and the machine has got these things that are flapping your arms. You have the wind blowing in your face, and you have the full headset on, and the sound, and just the distance that we are coming. I don't see that being something mainstream in, say, every household or school, but just the potential for technology to be transformative in the full sensory experience.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that. I've experienced VR only a few times, and it was really terrible. I will say that. The company will remain nameless. But I have seen examples, like you said, of like fully immersive, like flying and wind. And that's the exciting part that I'm like really jazzed about. even if I'm not sitting home actually strapping on a, you know, Oculus Rift thing and whatever. But I'm excited about the experiences just opening up so many different avenues for people, especially kids.
Well, and here's one of the things that we've been working on is augmented reality. So you look at the budgets that schools have, and they're not going to buy an Oculus Rift headset for every kid. But you can buy Google Hardboard for, you know,
right?
A few bucks. And sometimes, like, New York Times is given away free with a subscription. And you can use those. And a lot of kids have a phone.
There's a way that you can actually make cardboard. I mean, I think there's a pattern online where you can actually just make your own with just cardboard. So you can actually take an old box and then just make it yourself.
Well, the ones I've seen have had some lenses in them. But regardless, you could do it for, if not free, really, really, really cheap. So that opens up things to a lot of schools. And to me, it's kind of the analogy of black and white TV versus color, like when I was a kid, because I'm way older than either of you. You know, maybe your family couldn't afford a color TV, but you could afford a black and white TV, and it still had a lot of the same content. So with augmented reality, one of the possibilities that we're looking at is you're in a classroom, and so your kids have phones, and you maybe have a few lender phones for the kids who don't. And you drop them into these Google Cardboard devices, and you can have just black and white photos that you've put up around the classroom. And so they look at that, and that pattern matches what's in the game. And so all of a sudden, the ones that look over there, it's a forest, and they're going through the forest, and they could be learning about what types of wildlife lives in the forest, what types of plants. And then they could look over to that other one, and it would be a woodland scene. And so you could use that to learn, for example, about ecology, you know, in different environments. So there's a million things you could do with it that are really doable. That's why I'm so excited about technology. We have all these ideas. All we need is a lot more money and time to program them.
Isn't it amazing, like, how far advanced we've gotten? What were the things that we were using, the red things, and you put the little disc in?
Weren't they viewfinders?
Viewfinders. And so as you were, Anne-Marie, as you were describing this experience, I was like, wait, we've done this before, right? With the viewfinder, whether I think I had Snow White or something like that, and then I had other little, you know, things. But, you know, how I was sort of imagining this very close-up experience, and I was in my own head sort of imagining being there because this thing was on my eyes. But just in, what, 30 years or so, look how far advanced we've gotten, and I'm so super excited. And like you said, like, where the money will come and how this can be affordable so that it won't just be a select few of people who can experience this, but multiple people can experience this.
Well, and what I think is so exciting, too, is how much further the potential is to go. You know, I always joke with my children about how, you know, their version of, you know, I used to walk uphill both ways in the snow to school is going to be like, when I was young, when we were in the car, half the time the Netflix signal was so-so.
I'm just imagining, I thought the other day, like, I, for half of my life, there was no internet, right? I didn't have a cell phone. It's amazing. I typed in high school on a typewriter, not on a computer. It's just so fascinating.
Yes, they didn't come out with computers until I was out of my first master's degree. Computers that, like, the average person could afford. Because when I was in an undergrad, we still had punched cards. Now they showed them in the library tar pits. Yes. Maria's first sentence, by the way, was run Apple Vision.
Ooh.
Yes.
Really?
We had Apple II computer, and she was a little over a year old. She loved this little program on it. And yes, it was just what, you know, it would just take a line, it would go and draw a little room and then a table and a computer on the table and then a guy on the computer. And then it would do a little dance and play a little song. And it was the lowest res thing you could think of, but she was one and she loved it.
We've come a long way since the joystick and Oregon Trail, haven't we? Immensely far.
And if Seven Generation Games has anything to say about it, we have much farther to go.
Yes, I believe that too. And hopefully it will be more inclusive of the multitude of languages and people within the games.
Well, you know, it's funny you guys were talking about the viewfinder. I think when I was a kid, they called them a viewmaster. And I just happened to be at something a few weeks ago and met somebody who had worked on that. And he said it was, I think Mattel made it, but he said it was one of the longest selling lines they had, and they just discontinued it. And I said, oh, no, why? And he said, well, because the big thing they were sold a lot of them for was if you were on a car trip or if you had a restaurant to keep the kids entertained. He said, now everybody's got a cell phone, an iPad. And so There goes the market.
The kids are not pulling the little lever down. They're swiping on iPads, and we don't even have to teach kids how to do that. It's like almost they come out of the womb knowing how to swipe left and right. Scary.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary from Seven Generation Games. I'm Anne Maria DeMars.
I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Kiana Patterson.
This is the part of the podcast you've all been waiting for, where we put our More Than Ordinary guest in the More Than Ordinary hot seat and ask them to give us a More Than Ordinary tip.
So the one thing that I wish that people would have told me growing up, or even once I got to my 30s, is not to be afraid to fail. And I know that seems so cliche, right? But failure is just a natural part of life, and it makes us tougher and oftentimes makes us stronger. And even now today, I have to remind myself that I cannot be afraid to fail. I learn so much about myself and my surroundings and what I'm capable of doing when I stumble and fall and get right back up again.
Well, and that's one of the things we talk about a lot, obviously, because we're in gaming. But there is this sense, especially in the workplace, in the classroom, that failure is a terrible thing, you know, that you have failed. But in games, that's part of the expectation. You know, part of the expectation is to fail and to take some of that self-consciousness, some of that negativity out of failing, I think is really important.
And I think that that's something that we fail to teach kids. But like you said, in games, they learn so much, right? In Super Mario, like going down that path has taught me don't go down that path because there's a monster that's going to eat me and I'm not able to outrun it, right? So I've got to go the other way. And we learn by losing our life and then coming right back. And so in the game, obviously not literally, but I think that's the valuable part of gaming and the intersection of the world and our real lives is how do we figure out how to get back up again? And I want to teach kids that failure, perfection is not the answer, that life is really about learning, making mistakes, falling and getting back up and getting essentially back in the ring again. You're never going to be out for the count.
I think you're right. I think there's a very different view of failure in gaming. Mm-hmm. Jane McGonigal wrote a really good book called Reality is Broken, and she talks about failure in it in a couple of places. And one thing she says is Tetris, you cannot win. Tetris, it just gets harder and harder and harder until you eventually fail. I mean, this is like a terrible game. And as a teacher, if I said, we're just going to give kids more and more and more difficult problems until they eventually fail, you would say, you horrible old woman.
And I wouldn't want to do that. I want to keep on challenging kids. I want to keep on making sure that we are allowing them to be their fullest self. And I think that that comes with like, oh gosh, I suck at this, right? And I get back up and I try something all over again. And with, like you said, with Tetris, like it just gets harder and harder. And what pushes you? You just want to keep on beating it.
Exactly. Is failure teaches you both resilience and instills in you this desire to do better next time, which I think in life is the key to continuing to succeed and continuing to move forward.
Right. Grit. That's what they call it now, right? That's the trending word, grit, to have grit.
Well, I could go on at great length about education's answer to everything since having been around the block and back again. I've seen a lot of answers to everything. So yeah, you're right. Grit is the latest term. An interesting topic for another podcast is why we have this negative view of failure in schools. And that sounds really silly. Like, why wouldn't you have a negative view of failure in schools, in sports? But the fact is people fail in games and they still like to play them because it's not considered that failing is a permanent reflection on you. That we did a Kickstarter campaign, I think, or a commercial or something for Seven Generation Games. And my friend Eric, the same one who was president of the school board, made a comment about kids on his reservation. And he said, just because they haven't learned it yet doesn't mean they can't learn it. And that applies to anything in math, anything in academics, anything in life. And so I think if in schools we convey the idea of failure more that way, that you haven't learned to do division of fractions yet, as opposed to you failed, you suck at math.
Well, I can say this to the statistician in the room that I failed statistics the first time I took it. And it was awful. It was an awful feeling. And then I had to take it again. And then when I went back and got my MBA, I had to take it again. But by those times, I didn't fail it. But it taught me that first time, boy, I did something wrong here. And I've got to do something different the next time around. Otherwise, I'm not getting my degree without it. And so if I would have just been down for the count after that first time that I failed statistics, and I don't know where I would have been. But it did teach me, like, I better find a workaround quick and fast. I wish I would have had you as a professor. I'm sure I wouldn't have failed the first time, though.
I was just going to say, you didn't have it for me. Well, here's my very brief tip, and that is, don't be a jerk. Because there are people who say, well, I can't believe you failed statistics. And those people are jerks. You know, I have a PhD. I did really, really well in all of my statistics courses, even if I can't pronounce it this second. Aced everything. My husband went to UCLA in particle physics, and both of us had points in our careers in mathematics where we just thought, I will never understand this. And we barreled through it. And the people I see who tend to be the more, well, I can't believe you failed statistics, are the younger ones. You know, if you have that attitude, what it shows is you have limited experience, because no matter how brilliant you are, I guarantee you, you will hit a point somewhere in your career where you don't understand something, where you struggle with it. And if that isn't the case, then you're not challenging yourself enough.
And if it is the case, you don't want karma to come back and have a whole bunch of people going, oh, I can't believe you can't get that.
Well, what I've learned is that I'm a bona fide problem solver. So I'm going to work my way around so many different things, even if I'm not rooted in that particular skill set. I'm going to figure out a workaround. I'm not going to weasel my way out of it. I'm just going to figure out a new path, a new way to learn this, a new way to grasp a concept, and really push forward. And, you know, I can get statistics now, but I won't be a statistics professor. And I'm okay with that, quite frankly. But if I'm reading a document or a study and there's statistics and there's data there, I can read it, synthesize it, and understand it. That's all that matters to me today.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, sevengenerationgames.com. And that's seven, as in the number seven, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at sevengenerationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.